back then. As she walked into the brightly lit service station to pay for the petrol, she glanced up and caught sight of herself in a security mirror. Her face, she noticed, was very pink. Chapter 18. "You've read it, then," said John Paul. Cecilia looked at him, as if she'd never seen him before. A middle-aged man who had once been very handsome, and still was, to her, at least. John Paul had one of those honest, trustworthy faces. You'd buy a used car from John Paul. That famous Fitzpatrick jaw. All the Fitzpatrick boys had strong jaws. He had a good head of hair, grey and thick. He was still vain about his hair. He liked to blow dry it. His brothers gave him hell about that. He stood at the door of the study, wearing his blue and white striped boxer shorts and a red T-shirt. His face was pale and sweaty, as if he had food poisoning. She hadn't heard him come down from the attic or walk down the hallway. She didn't know how long he'd been standing there while she sat staring unseeingly at her hands, which she saw now were clasped angelically in her lap, like a little girl in church. "I've read it," she said. She pulled the sheet of paper over to her and read it again, slowly, as if this time, now that John Paul was standing in front of her, it would surely say something different. It was written in blue ballpoint pen on a lined piece of paper. It felt ridged, like braille. He must have pressed hard with his pen, as if he was trying to engrave each word into the paper. There were no paragraphs or spaces. The words were crammed together without a break. "My darling Cecilia, if you're reading this, then I've died. Which sounds so melodramatic to write down, but I guess everyone dies. You're in the hospital right now with our baby girl, Isabel. She was born early this morning. She's so beautiful and tiny and helpless. I've never felt anything like what I felt when I held her for the first time. I'm already terrified that something will happen to her. And that's why I have to write this down. Just in case something does happen to me, at least I have done this. At least I could have tried to make it right. I've had a few beers. I might not be making sense. I probably will tear this letter up. Cecilia, I have to tell you that when I was 17, I killed Janie Crowley. If her parents are still alive, will you please tell them that I'm sorry and that it was an accident? It wasn't planned. I lost my temper. I was 17 and so fucking stupid. I can't believe it was me. It feels like a nightmare. It feels like I must have been on drugs or drunk, but I wasn't. I was perfectly sober. I just snapped. I had a brain snap, like those idiot rugby players say. It sounds like I'm trying to justify it, but I'm not trying to make excuses. I did this unimaginable thing, and I can't explain it. I know what you're thinking, Cecilia, because everything is black and white for you. You're thinking, why didn't he confess? But you know why I couldn't go to jail, Cecilia. You know I couldn't be locked up. I know I'm a coward. That's why I tried to kill myself when I was 18, but I didn't have the balls to go through with it. Please tell Ed and Rachel Crowley that I never went a day without thinking of their daughter. Tell them it happened so fast. Janie was laughing just seconds before. She was happy right up until the end. Maybe that just sounds awful. It does sound awful. Don't tell them that. It was an accident, Cecilia. Janie told me she was in love with some other kid, and then she laughed at me. That's all she did. I lost my mind. Please tell the Crowleys that I'm so sorry. I couldn't be sorrier. Please tell Ed Crowley that now I'm a dad, I understand exactly what I've done. The guilt has been like a tumor eating away at me, and now it's worse than ever. I'm so sorry to leave you with this, Cecilia, but I know you're strong enough to handle it. I love you and our baby so much, and you've given me more happiness than I ever deserved. I deserved nothing, and I got everything. I'm so sorry. With all my love, John Paul. Cecilia thought she'd experienced anger before, plenty of times. But now she knew that she'd had no idea how real anger felt. The white, hot, burning purity of it. It was a frantic, crazy, wonderful feeling. She felt like she could fly. She could fly across the room like a demon and claw bloody scratch marks down John Paul's face. "Is it true?" she said. She was disappointed by the sound of her voice. It was weak. It didn't sound like it came from someone who was wild with anger. "Is it true?" she said again, stronger. She knew it was true, but her desire for it not to be true was so overpowering she had to ask. She wanted to beg for it to be made untrue. "I'm sorry," he said. His eyes were bloodshot and rolling about like a terrified horse. "But you'd never," said Cecilia. "You wouldn't. You couldn't." "I can't explain it." "You didn't even know Janie Crowley." She corrected herself. "I didn't even know you knew her. You never even mentioned her." At the mention of Janie's name, John Paul began to visibly shake. He clung to the sides of the doorframe. Seeing him shake like that was even more shocking than the actual words he'd written. "If you died," she said, "if you died and I'd found this letter..." She stopped. She couldn't breathe for the fury. "How could you just leave that for me? Leave me to do that for you? Expect me to turn up on Rachel Crowley's doorstep and tell her this thing?" She stood up, covered her face with her hands, and turned around in circles. She was naked, she noted without particular interest. Her T-shirt had ended up at the bottom of the bed after they'd had sex, and she hadn't bothered to find it. "I drove Rachel home tonight. I drove her home. I talked to her about Janie. I thought I was so great for telling her this memory I had of Janie. And all the time, this letter was sitting here." She removed her hands and looked at him. "What if one of the girls had found it, John Paul?" That had only just occurred to her. It was so momentous, so dreadful, she had to say it again. "What if one of the girls had found it?" "I know," he whispered. He came into the room and stood with his back up against the wall and looked at her as if he was facing a firing squad. "I'm sorry." She watched as his legs gave way and he slid to the carpet to a sitting position. "Why would you write it?" She picked up the corner of the letter and dropped it again. "How could you put something like that in writing?" "I'd had too much to drink. And then the next day I tried to find it so I could tear it up." He looked up at her tearfully. "And I'd lost it. I nearly lost my mind looking for it. I must have been working on my tax return and then it got caught up in some of the papers. I thought I'd looked..." "Stop it!" she shouted. She couldn't bear to hear him talking with his usual hopeless wonder about the way things got lost and then turned up again, as if this letter was something perfectly ordinary, like an unpaid car insurance bill. John Paul put a finger to his lips. "You'll wake the girls," he said tremulously. His nervousness made her feel sick. "Be a man," she wanted to scream. "Make this go away. Take this thing off me." It was a disgusting, ugly, horrible creature he needed to destroy. It was an impossibly heavy box he needed to lift from her arms. And he wasn't doing anything. A tiny voice floated down the hallway. "Daddy!" It was Polly, their lightest sleeper. She always called for her father. Cecilia would not do. Only her father could make the monsters go away. Only her father. Her father who had killed a 17-year-old girl. Her father who was a monster himself. Her father who had kept this evil, unspeakable secret for all these years. It was like she hadn't fully comprehended any of it until this moment. The shock winded her. She collapsed into the black leather chair. "Daddy!"
"Coming, Polly."
John Paul got slowly to his feet, using the wall to support himself. He gave Cecilia a desperate look and headed down the hallway towards Polly's room. Cecilia focused on her breathing, in through the nostrils. She saw Janie Crowley's 12-year-old face. "It's only stupid marching," out through the mouth. She saw the grainy black-and-white picture of Janie that had appeared on the front cover of the newspapers, a long blonde ponytail falling down one shoulder. All murder victims looked exactly like murder victims, beautiful, innocent, and doomed, as if it was preordained. In through the nostrils. She saw Rachel Crowley gently banging her forehead against the car window, out through the mouth. What to do, Cecilia? What to do? How could she fix it? How could she make it right? She fixed things. She made things right. She put things in order. All you had to do was pick up the phone, get on the internet, fill in the right forms, talk to the right people, arrange the refund, the replacement, the better model. Except that nothing would ever bring Janie back. Her mind kept returning to that one cold, immovable, awful fact. Like an enormous wall that couldn't be crossed. She began ripping the letter into tiny pieces. Confess. John Paul would have to confess. That was obvious. He would have to come clean, make it all clean and shiny. Scrub it away. Follow the rules. The law. He'd have to go to prison. He'd have to be sentenced. A sentence. Put behind bars. But he couldn't be locked up. He'd lose his mind. So then, medication. Therapy. She'd talk to people. Do the research. He wouldn't be the first prisoner with claustrophobia. Weren't those cells actually quite spacious? They had exercise yards, didn't they? Claustrophobia didn't actually kill you. It just made you feel like you couldn't breathe. Whereas two hands placed around the neck could kill you. He'd strangled Janie Crowley. He'd actually put his hands around her thin, girlish neck and squeezed. Didn't that make him evil? Yes. The answer had to be yes. John Paul was evil. She kept tearing at the letter, shredding the pieces into tinier and tinier fragments until she could roll them between her fingertips. Her husband was evil. So, therefore, he must go to jail. Cecilia would be the wife of a prisoner. She wondered if there was a social club for the wives. She'd set one up if there wasn't. She giggled hysterically like a crazy woman. Of course she would. She was Cecilia. She'd be president of the Prisoners' Wives Association and organise fundraising for air conditioning units to be put in their poor husbands' cells. Did prisons have air conditioning? Or was it just primary schools that missed out? She imagined chatting with the other wives while they waited to go in through the metal detectors. What's your husband in for? Oh, bank robbery. Really? Mine's in for murder. Yeah, strangle the girl. Off to the gym after this, are you? She's gone back off, said John Paul. He'd returned to the study, standing in front of her, massaging little circles under his cheekbones, the way he did when he was exhausted. He didn't look evil. He looked just like her husband. Unshaven, messy hair, shadows under his eyes. Her husband, the father of her children. If he'd killed someone once, what was to stop him doing it again? She'd just let him go into Polly's room. She'd just let a murderer go into her daughter's room. But it was John Paul, their father. He was daddy. How could they tell the girls what John Paul had done? Daddy is going to jail. For a moment, her mind stopped completely. They could never tell the girls. I'm so sorry, said John Paul. He held out his arms uselessly, as if he wanted to hold her, but they were separated by something too vast to be crossed. Darling, I'm just so sorry. Cecilia wrapped her arms around her naked body. She trembled violently. Her teeth chattered. I'm having a nervous breakdown, she thought with relief. I'm about to lose my mind. And that's just as well, because this cannot possibly be fixed. It is simply not fixable. Chapter 19. There. See? Rachel hit the pause button so that Connor Whitby's angry face was frozen on the screen. It was the face of a monster. His eyes were evil black holes. His lips were pulled back in a rabid sneer. Rachel had watched the footage 4 times now, and each time she became more convinced. It was, she thought, quite stunningly conclusive. Show this to any jury and they'd convict. She turned to look at former Sergeant Rodney Bellark sitting on her couch, leaning forward with his elbows on his knees, and caught him flattening his hand across his mouth to stifle a yawn. Well, it was the middle of the night. Sergeant Bellark... You can just call me plain old Rodney now, he kept telling her, had obviously been deeply asleep when she'd called. His wife had answered the phone, and Rachel had overheard her trying to wake him up. Rodney? Rodney! It's for you! When he finally got on the phone, his voice had been thick and slurred with sleep. I'll be right there, Mrs. Crowley. He'd finally said, when she'd made him understand, and as he put down the phone, Rachel had heard his wife say, Where, Rodney? You'll be right where? Why can't it wait until the morning? His wife sounded like a right old nag. It probably could have waited until the morning, reflected Rachel now, as she saw Rodney valiantly struggling to repress another massive yawn and rubbing his knuckles into his bleary eyes. At least he would have been more alert then. He really didn't look well at all. Apparently he'd recently been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. He'd made some dramatic changes to his diet. He'd mentioned all this as they sat down to watch the video. Completely cut out all sugar, he'd said sadly. No more ice cream for dessert. Mrs. Crowley, he said finally, I can certainly see why you would think that this proves Connor had a motive of some sort. But I have to be honest with you. I just don't think it's enough to convince the boys to take a second look.
He was in love with her, said Rachel. He was in love with her, and she was rejecting him.
Your daughter was a very pretty girl, said Sergeant Bellark. Probably a lot of boys were in love with her. Rachel was gobsmacked. How had she never noticed that Rodney was so stupid, so obtuse? Had the diabetes affected his IQ? Had the lack of ice cream shrunk his brain? But Connor wasn't just any boy. He was the last one to see her before she died, she said slowly and carefully to make sure he understood.
He had an alibi.
His mother was his alibi, said Rachel. She lied, obviously.
And his mother's boyfriend backed it up too, said Rodney. But more importantly, there was a neighbour who saw Connor put out the rubbish bin at 5 p.m. The neighbour was a very reliable witness, a solicitor and a father of three. I remember every detail of Janie's case, Mrs. Crowley. I can assure you, if I thought we had anything, lies in his eyes, interrupted Rachel.
You said Connor Whitby had lies in his eyes. Well, you were right. You were exactly right, Rodney said.
But see, all this proves is that they had a little tiff.
A little tiff, cried Rachel. Look at that boy's face. He killed her. I know he killed her. I know it in my heart, in my...
She was going to say body, but she didn't want to sound like a loony.
It was true, though. Her body was telling her what Connor had done. It was burning all over, as if she had a fever. Even her fingertips felt hot.
Well, you know what? I'll see what I can do, Mrs. Crowley, said Rodney. I'm not making any promises about whether it will go anywhere, but I can promise you this video will get into the right hands.
Thank you. That's all I can ask. It was a lie. She could ask for a lot more. She wanted a police car with a shrieking, whirling siren to race to Connor Whitby's house right this second. She wanted Connor handcuffed while a grim-faced, burly police officer read him his rights. Oh, and she did not want that police officer to tenderly protect Connor's head when they put him in the back of the police car. She wanted Connor's head smashed over and over until it was nothing but a bloody pulp.
How's that little grandson of yours?
Growing up?
Rodney picked up a framed photo of Jacob from the mantelpiece, while Rachel ejected the video cassette.
He's going to New York.
Rachel handed him the cassette.
No kidding.
Rodney took the cassette and carefully replaced Jacob's photo.
My oldest granddaughter is off to New York too. She's 18 now. Little Emily. Got herself a scholarship to some top university. The Big Apple, they call it, don't they? Wonder why they call it that.
Rachel gave him a sickly smile and led him to the front door.
I have absolutely no idea, Rodney. No idea at all.
The 17th of April, 1984. On the morning of the last day of her life, Janie Crowley sat next to Connor Whitby on the bus. She felt strangely breathless, and she tried to calm herself by breathing in slowly with slow, deep breaths from the diaphragm. It didn't seem to help. "Calm down," she told herself. "I've got something to say," she said. He didn't say anything. He never did say much, thought Janie. She watched him studying his hands resting on his knees, and she studied them herself. He had very big hands, she saw with a shiver of fear or anticipation, or both. Her own hands were icy cold. They were always cold. She slid them under her jumper to warm them. She said, "I've made a decision." He turned his head suddenly to look at her. The bus lurched as it went around a corner, and their bodies slid closer so that their eyes were only inches apart. She was breathing so fast, she wondered if there was something wrong with her. "Tell me," he said. Wednesday. Chapter 20. The alarm clock wrenched Cecilia cruelly, instantly awake at 6:30 a.m. She was lying on her side facing John Paul, and their eyes opened simultaneously. They were so close, their noses were almost touching. She looked at the delicate scribbles of red veins in the whites of John Paul's blue eyes, the pores on his nose, the grey stubble on his strong, firm, honest chin. Who was this man? Last night they had got back into bed and lay together in the darkness, staring blindly at the ceiling while John Paul talked. How he'd talked. There had been no need to probe for information. She didn't ask a single question. He wanted to talk, to tell her everything. His voice was low and fervent, without modulation, almost monotonous. Except there was nothing monotonous about what he was telling her. The more he talked, the hoarser his voice got. It was like a nightmare, lying in the dark, listening to that raspy whisper of his, going on and on and on. She had to bite her lip to stop herself from screaming, "Shut up, shut up, shut up!" He'd been in love with Janie Crowley. Crazy in love. Obsessed, even. The way you think you're in love when you're a teenager. He met her one day at Hornsby McDonald's when they were both filling in applications for part-time work. Janie recognized him from when they'd been at primary school together, before he'd gone off to his exclusive boys' school. They'd been in the same year at St. Angela's, but in different classes. He didn't actually remember her at all, although he sort of knew the Crowley name. Neither of them ended up working at the McDonald's. Janie got a job at the dry cleaners, and John Paul got a job at the milk bar. But they had this amazing, intense conversation about God knows what, and she gave him her phone number, and he rang her the next day. He thought she was his girlfriend. He thought he was going to lose his virginity to her. It all had to be really secretive, because Janie's dad was one of those crazy Catholic dads, and he said she couldn't even have a boyfriend until she was 18. Their relationship, such as it was, had to be completely secret. That only made it more exciting. It was like they were secret agents. If he rang her house, and anyone but Janie answered, the rule was that he had to hang up. They never held hands in public. None of their friends knew. Janie insisted on this. They went to the movies once and held hands in the dark. They kissed on a train in an empty carriage. They sat in the rotunda at Wattle Valley Park and smoked cigarettes and talked about how they wanted to go to Europe before uni. And that was it, really. Except that he thought about her day and night. He wrote her poetry he was too embarrassed to give her. "He never wrote me poetry," thought Cecilia irrelevantly. That night, Janie asked him to meet her in Wattle Valley Park, where they'd met often before. It was always deserted, and there was the rotunda where they could sit and kiss. She said she had something to tell him. He thought she was going to tell him that she'd gone to the family planning center and got the pill. They'd talked about that. But instead, she said that she was sorry, that she was in love with another boy. John Paul was stunned, bewildered. He didn't know there was another boy in the running. He said, "But I thought you were my girlfriend." And she laughed. She seemed so happy, John Paul said, so happy that she wasn't his girlfriend, and he was just crushed and humiliated and filled with this incredible rage. It was his pride more than anything. He felt like a fool, and for that, he wanted to kill her. John Paul seemed desperate for Cecilia to know this. He said he didn't want to justify it or mitigate it or pretend it was an accident because for a few seconds he absolutely felt the desire to kill. He didn't remember making the decision to put his hands around her neck, but he remembered the moment when he suddenly became aware of the slender, girlish neck between his hands and realized it wasn't one of his brothers he had in a chokehold. He was hurting a girl. He remembered thinking, "What the fuck am I doing?" And he dropped his hand so fast, and he actually felt relieved because he was so sure he'd caught himself in time that he hadn't killed her. Except that she was limp in his arms, her eyes staring over his shoulder. And he thought, no, this couldn't be possible. He thought it had only been a second, maybe 2 seconds of crazy rage, definitely not long enough to kill her. He couldn't believe it. Even now, after all these years, he was still shocked and horrified by what he'd done. She was still warm, but he knew without a shadow of doubt that she was dead. Although later, he wondered if he could have been wrong. Why hadn't he even tried to revive her? He must have asked himself that question a million times. But at the time, he had felt so sure. She was gone. She felt gone. So he laid her carefully at the bottom of the slide, and he remembered thinking that the night was getting cold, so he put her school blazer over the top of her. And he had his mum's rosary beads in his pocket because he'd done an exam that day, and he always took them for luck. So he placed them carefully in Janie's hands. It was his way of saying sorry to Janie and to God. And then he ran. He ran and ran until he couldn't breathe. He thought for sure he would be caught. He kept waiting for the heavy weight of a policeman's hand to drop on his shoulder. But he was never even questioned. He and Janie weren't at the same school or in the same youth group. Neither their parents nor friends had known about them. It seemed that nobody had ever seen them together. It was like it had never happened. He said that if the police had ever questioned him, he would have confessed immediately. He said that if someone else had been accused of the murder, he would have given himself up. He wouldn't have let anyone else take the fall for it. He wasn't that evil. It was just that nobody asked the question, so he never gave the answer. During the 90s, he started hearing news reports about crimes being solved through DNA evidence, and he wondered if he'd left a minuscule vestige of himself behind. A single hair, for example. But even if he had, they'd been together for such a short time, and they'd played their undercover game so effectively. He would never be asked to give a DNA sample, because nobody knew he had known Janie. He could almost convince himself that he hadn't known her. That it had never happened. And then the years had just gone by. Layers and layers of years piled on top of the memory of what he'd done. Sometimes, he whispered, he could go for months feeling relatively normal, and then other times he could think of nothing else except what he'd done, and he was sure he'd go crazy.
"It's like a monster trapped in my mind," he rasped, "and sometimes it gets free and goes rampaging about, and then I get it under control again. I chain it up. You know what I mean?"
"No," thought Cecilia. "No, actually, I don't."
"And then I met you," said John Paul. "And I sensed something about you, a deep down goodness. I fell in love with your goodness. It was like looking at a beautiful lake. It was like you were somehow purifying me."
Cecilia was appalled. "I'm not good," she thought. "I smoked marijuana once. We used to get drunk together. I thought you fell in love with my figure, my sparkling company, my sense of humour. Not my goodness, for God's sake." He kept talking, seemingly desperate for her to know every tiny detail. "When Isabel was born and he became a parent, he suddenly had a new and terrible understanding of exactly what he'd done to Rachel and Ed Crowley. When we were living on Bell Avenue, I used to drive by Janie's father walking his dog on my way to work," he said. "And his face, it looked, I don't know how to describe it, like he was in such terrible physical pain that he should have been rolling about on the floor. Except he wasn't. He was walking the dog. And I'd think, I did that to him. I'm responsible for that pain. I tried to leave the house at different times or drive different ways, but I kept seeing him." They'd lived in the house on Bell Avenue when Isabel was a baby. Cecilia's memories of Bell Avenue smelled of baby shampoo and nappy cream and mashed pear and banana. She and John Paul had been besotted by their new baby. Sometimes he'd go in late to work so he could spend longer lying on the bed with Isabel in her little white bond suit, nuzzling her plump, firm tummy. Except that wasn't true. He was trying to avoid seeing the father of the girl he'd murdered. "I'd see Ed Crowley and I'd think, that's it, I've got to confess," he said. "But then I'd think about you and the baby. How could I do that to you? How could I tell you? How could I leave you to bring up a baby on your own? I thought about us leaving Sydney. But I knew you wouldn't want to leave your parents, and anyway, it felt wrong. It felt like running away. I had to stay here, where at any moment I could run into Janie's parents and know what I'd done. I had to suffer. So that's when I had an idea. I had to find new ways to punish myself, to suffer without making anyone else suffer. I had to do penance. If anything gave him too much pleasure, pleasure that was solely for him, then he gave it up. That was why he gave up rowing. He loved it, so he had to stop because Janie never got to row. He sold his beloved Alfa Romeo because Janie never got to drive a car. He devoted himself to the community as if a judge had ordered him to do so many hours of community service. Cecilia had thought he was community-minded. She'd thought that was something they had in common, when in fact the John Paul she thought she knew didn't even exist. He was a fabrication. His whole life was an act for God's benefit, to let him off the hook. He said the community service thing was tricky, Because what about when he enjoyed it? For example, he loved being a volunteer bushfire fighter. The camaraderie, the jokes, the adrenaline. So, did his enjoyment outweigh his contribution to the community? He was always calculating, wondering what else God would expect of him, how much more he would have to pay. Of course, he knew that none of it was enough, and that he would probably go to hell when he died. He's serious, thought Cecilia. He really believes he's going to hell, as if hell is an actual physical place, not an abstract idea. He was referring to God in a chillingly familiar way. They weren't that type of Catholics. They were Catholics, sure, they went to church, but heavens above, they weren't religious. God didn't come into their day-to-day conversation. Except, of course, this wasn't a day-to-day conversation. He kept talking. It was endless. Cecilia thought of that urban myth about an exotic worm that lived in your body, and the only cure was to starve yourself and then place a hot dinner in front of your mouth and wait for the worm to smell the food and slowly uncoil itself, sliding its way up your throat. John Paul's voice was like that worm, an endless length of horror slipping from his mouth. He told her that as the girls grew older, his guilt and regret were becoming almost unendurable. The nightmares, the migraines, the bouts of depression that he'd tried so hard to hide from her were all because of what he'd done. Earlier this year, Isabel started to remind me of Jamie, said John Paul. Something about the way she was wearing her hair. I kept staring at her. It was terrible. I kept imagining someone hurting Isabel the way I hurt Janie, an innocent little girl. I felt like I had to put myself through the grief that I put her parents through. I had to imagine her dead. I've been crying. In the shower, in the car, sobbing. Esther saw you crying before you went to Chicago, said Cecilia. In the shower. Did she? John Paul blinked. For a moment, there was beautiful silence as he digested this. Okay, thought Cecilia. We're done. He stopped talking. Thank God. She felt a physical and mental exhaustion she hadn't experienced since she'd been through labor. I gave up sex, said John Paul. For God's sake. He wanted her to know that last November he was trying to think of new ways to punish himself, and he decided to give up sex for 6 months. He was ashamed that he'd never thought of it before. It was one of the greatest pleasures of his life. It had nearly killed him. He'd been worried she might think he was having an affair because, obviously, he couldn't tell her the real reason. Oh, John Paul. Cecilia sighed into the darkness. This perpetual quest for redemption he'd been undertaking for all these years seemed so silly, so childish, so utterly pointless, and so typically unsystematic. I invited Rachel Crowley to Polly's pirate party, said Cecilia, remembering, marvelling at the idiotically innocent person she'd been just a few hours earlier. I drove her home tonight. I talked to her about Janie. I thought I was so great. Her voice broke. She heard John Paul take a deep, shuddery breath. I'm so sorry, he said. I know I keep saying it. I know it's useless. It's all right, she said, and nearly laughed because it was such a lie. That was the last thing she remembered before the two of them must have suddenly fallen into a deep, drug-like sleep. Are you okay? Said John Paul now. Do you feel all right? She smelled his stale morning breath. Her own mouth felt dry. Her head ached. She felt hungover, seedy and ashamed, as if the two of them had engaged in some disgusting debauchery the previous night. She pressed two fingertips to her forehead and closed her eyes, unable to look at him any longer. Her neck ached. She must have slept at a funny angle.
"Do you think you still..."
He stopped himself and cleared his throat convulsively. He finally spoke in a whisper.
"Can you still be with me?"
She looked into his eyes and saw pure primal terror. Did one act define who you were forever? Did one evil act as a teenager counteract 20 years of marriage? Of good marriage? 20 years of being a good husband and a good father? Murder, and you are a murderer. That was how it worked for other people, for strangers, for people you read about in the newspaper. Cecilia was sure about that, but did different rules apply to John Paul? And if so, why? There was a rapid pitter-patter of footsteps down the hallway, and suddenly a small, warm body catapulted itself onto their bed. "Good morning, Mum," said Polly, as she breezily wriggled herself between them. She shoved her head onto Cecilia's pillow. Strands of her blue-black hair tickled Cecilia's nose.
"Hello, Daddy."
Cecilia looked at her youngest daughter as if she'd never seen her before. Her flawless skin, the long sweep of her eyelashes, and the brilliant blue of her eyes. Everything about her was exquisite and pure. Cecilia's eyes met John Paul's with perfect, bloodshot understanding. This was why. "Hello, Polly," they said together. Chapter 21. Liam said something Tess couldn't hear, dropped her hand, and stopped right at the entrance to St. Angela's. The flood of parents and children changed course to cope with the sudden obstacle in their path, streaming around them. Tess bent down next to him, and someone's elbow banged against the back of her head. "What is it?" she said, rubbing her head. She felt twitchy, nervy, and overstimulated. School drop-off was just as bad here as in Melbourne, a very particular version of hell for someone like her. People, people, everywhere. "I want to go back home." Liam spoke to the ground. "I want Daddy." "What's that?" said Tess, although she'd heard. She tried to take him by the hand. "Let's get out of everybody's way first." She knew this had been coming. It had all been suspiciously, oddly easy. Liam had seemed strangely sanguine about this abrupt, unplanned change of schools. "He's so adaptable," Tess's mother had marvelled. But Tess had thought it had more to do with the problems he'd been experiencing at his old school than actual enthusiasm about starting a new one. Liam dragged on her arm, so she had to bend back down again. "You and Daddy and Felicity should stop fighting," he said, cupping his hand around Tess's ear. His breath was warm and toothpaste-scented. "Just say sorry to each other. Say you didn't mean it. So we can go back home." Tessa's heart stopped. Stupid. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Had she really thought she could put this over Liam? He'd always surprised her with how well he observed what was going on around him. "Grandma can come and stay with us in Melbourne," said Liam. "We can look after her there until her ankle gets better." Funny. That had never actually occurred to Tess. It was as if she thought her life in Melbourne and her mother's life in Sydney took place on different planets.
They have wheelchairs at the airport, said Liam solemnly,
just as the edge of a little girl's backpack swung against his face and caught the corner of his eye. His face crumpled and tears spilled from his beautiful golden eyes. Honey, she said helplessly, on the edge of tears herself, look, you don't have to go to school at all. This was a crazy idea.
Well, good morning, Liam. I was wondering if you were here yet.
It was that dotty school principal. She crouched down on her haunches next to Liam as easily as a child. She must do yoga, thought Tess. A boy about the same age as Liam walked by and gave her a loving pat on her grey, frizzy-haired head, as if she was the school dog, not the school principal.
Hello, Miss Appleby.
Good morning, Harrison.
Trudy lifted a hand, and her shawl slid off her shoulders. I'm sorry, we're creating a traffic jam here, began Tess. But Trudy just smiled slightly in her direction, readjusted her shawl with one hand, and returned her attention to Liam.
Do you know what your teacher, Mrs. Jeffers, and I did yesterday afternoon?
Liam shrugged and roughly brushed away his tears.
We turned your classroom into another planet.
Her eyes sparkled.
Our Easter egg hunt is in outer space.
Liam sniffed and looked extremely cynical.
How? He said. How'd you do that?
Come and see.
Trudy stood up and took Liam's hand. Say bye to your mum. You can tell her how many eggs you found in space this afternoon. Tess kissed the top of his head.
Okay, well, have a wonderful day and don't forget I'll... There's a spaceship, of course.
Guess who gets to fly it?
Said Trudy, leading him away. And Tess saw Liam glance up at the school principal, his face suddenly bright with cautious hope, before he was swallowed up in a crowd of blue and white checked uniforms. Tess turned and headed back out onto the street. She felt that strangely untethered feeling she always felt when she left Liam in someone else's care, as if gravity had disappeared. What would she do with herself now? And what was she going to say to him after school today? She couldn't lie and tell him that there was nothing going on, but she couldn't tell him the truth, could she?
Daddy and Felicity are in love. Daddy is meant to love me best, so I'm feeling angry with them. I'm feeling very hurt. Supposedly, the truth was always the best option.
She'd rushed into this. She'd pretended to herself that she was doing everything for Liam. She'd yanked her child from his home and his school and his life, because in actual fact, that was what she wanted to do. She wanted to be as far away from Will and Felicity as possible, and now Liam's happiness was dependent on a peculiar, frizzy-haired woman called Trudy Appleby. Maybe she should homeschool him until all this was sorted out. She could handle most of it. English, geography, it could be fun. But maths, that was her downfall. Felicity had got Tess through maths when they were at school, and now she was in charge of helping Liam with his maths. Felicity had said just the other day that she was quite looking forward to rediscovering the quadratic equation when Liam was in high school, and Tess and Will had looked at each other, shuddered, and laughed. Felicity and Will had behaved so normally. All that time, hugging their little secret to themselves. She was walking along the street outside the school, back towards her mother's house, when she heard a voice behind her.
Good morning, Tess.
It was Cecilia Fitzpatrick, suddenly walking alongside her in the same direction, chunky car keys jangling from one hand. There was something odd about the way she was walking, as if she had a limp. Tess took a deep, bracing breath.
"Morning," she said.
"Just dropped Liam off for his first day, did you?" said Cecilia. She was wearing sunglasses, so Tess was spared the scary eye contact. She sounded as if she was coming down with a cold.
"Was he okay? Always a bit tricky."
"Oh, well, not really, but Trudy..." Tess stopped, distracted, because she'd just noticed Cecilia's shoes. They weren't matching. One was a black ballet shoe. The other was a gold sandal with a heel. No wonder she was walking funny. She looked away and remembered to keep talking. But Trudy was wonderful with him.
"Ah, yes. Trudy is one in a million, that's for sure," said Cecilia. "Anyway, this is my car here."
She indicated a very shiny white four-wheel drive with the Tupperware logo along the side.
"We forgot Polly had sport today. I never... Anyway, we forgot, so I've got to drive home and get her shoes. Polly is in love with the PE teacher, so I'll be in terrible trouble if I'm late."
"Connor," said Tess. "Connor Whitby. He's her PE teacher." She thought of him last night at the service station, his helmet under one arm.
"Yes, that's right. All the little girls are in love with him. Actually, half the mothers are, too."
"Really?" Slosh, slosh, went that waterbed.
"Good morning, Tess."
"Hi there, Cecilia." It was Rachel Crowley, the school secretary, walking from the other direction, wearing a pair of white running shoes with her business-like skirt and silk shirt. Tess wondered if anyone ever looked at Rachel without thinking about Janie Crowley and what had happened to her in that park. It was impossible to think that Rachel had once been an ordinary woman, that no one could have sensed the tragedy that was waiting for her. Rachel stopped in front of them. More conversation. It was endless. She looked tired and pale, her white hair not quite as beautifully blow-dried as it had been when Tess had met her yesterday.
"Thanks again for the lift home last night," she said to Cecilia.
She smiled at Tess.
"I was at one of Cecilia's Tupperware parties last night and had too much to drink. That's why I'm on foot today."
She gestured at her shoes.
"Shameful, isn't it?"
There was an awkward silence. Tess had confidently expected Cecilia to speak next, but she seemed distracted by something off in the distance and was strangely, almost bizarrely, silent.
"Sounds like you had a fun night," said Tess finally.
Her voice sounded too loud and hearty. Why couldn't she just speak like a normal person?
It was, actually."
Rachel frowned slightly at Cecilia, who still hadn't said a word. She turned her attention back to Tess.
"Did Liam go off to his classroom okay?"
"Miss Appleby took him under her wing," said Tess.
"That's good," said Rachel. "He'll be fine. Trudy takes special care of the new children." "I'd better go start my day. Get out of these ridiculous-looking clodhoppers."
"Bye, girls."
"Have a great..."
Cecilia's voice came out husky, and she cleared her throat.
"Have a great day, Rachel."
"You too." Rachel headed off towards the school.
"Well," said Tess.
"Oh, dear," said Cecilia. She pressed her fingertips to her mouth. "I think I'm going..." She looked around her agitatedly, as if she was searching for something.
"Shit!"
And suddenly, she was crouched in the gutter, being violently sick.
"Oh, God,"
thought Tess, as the awful retching sounds went on and on. She did not want to see Cecilia Fitzpatrick being sick in a gutter. Was it a hangover from the previous night? Food poisoning? Should she crouch down beside her and hold back her hair like girlfriends did for each other in nightclub toilets after too many tequilas? Like she and Felicity had once done for each other. Or should she gently rub Cecilia's back in a circular motion like she did for Liam when he was sick? Should she at least make some soothing, sympathetic sounds as she stood here watching to show she cared? Rather than just standing here, wincing and looking the other way? But she barely knew the woman. When she was pregnant with Liam, Tess had suffered from chronic all-day-long morning sickness. She'd thrown up in numerous public places, and her only wish had been to be left alone. Perhaps she should slip quietly away. But she couldn't just abandon the poor woman. She looked around her desperately for another school mum, one of those capable sorts who would know what to do. Cecilia would have dozens of friends at the school, but the street was suddenly deserted and quiet. Then she was struck by a wonderful inspiration. Tissues. The thought of being able to offer Cecilia something both useful and appropriate filled her with something ridiculously akin to joy. She rustled through her handbag and found a small unopened packet of tissues and a bottle of water. "You're like a Boy Scout," Will had said to her early on in their relationship when she'd pulled a small flashlight from her bag after he'd dropped his car keys on a dark street on their way home from a movie. "If we got stuck on a desert island, we could be self-sufficient thanks to Tess's handbag," Felicity had said. Because, of course, Felicity had been there too that night, she remembered now. When had Felicity ever not been there? "My goodness me," said Cecilia. She straightened up, plonked herself on the curb, and wiped the back of her hand across her mouth. "How embarrassing." "Here." Tess handed over the tissues. "Are you all right? Was it something you maybe ate?" Cecilia's hands, Tess noticed, were trembling badly, and her face was pasty white. "I don't know." Cecilia blew her nose and looked up at Tess. There were purplish crescents under her streaming eyes and tiny flecks of mascara on her eyelids. She looked dreadful. "I'm so sorry about this. You must go. You've probably got a million things to do." "I don't actually have a thing to do," said Tess. "Not a thing in the world." She undid the bottle cap. "Sip of water?" "Thank you." Cecilia took the water bottle and drank. She went to stand up and staggered. Tess grabbed her arm just before she fell. "Sorry. So sorry." Cecilia was almost sobbing. "It's fine." Tess held her up. "It's perfectly fine. I think I should drive you home." "Oh, no, no. That's so sweet of you, but I'm really fine." "No, you're not," said Tess. "I'll drive you home. You can hop into bed, and I'll drop your daughter's shoes back off at the school."
"I can't believe I nearly forgot Polly's damned shoes again," said Cecilia. She looked utterly appalled at herself, as if she'd put Polly's life at risk.
"Come on," said Tess. She took Cecilia's keys from her unresisting hand, pointed the key at the Tupperware car, and pressed the unlock button. She was filled with an unusual sense of capability and purpose.
"Thank you for this."
Cecilia leaned heavily on Tess's arm as she helped her into the passenger side of her car.
"It's no problem at all," said Tess,
in a brisk, no-nonsense voice entirely unlike her own, closing the door and heading around to the driver's side.
"How kind and civic of you," Felicity spoke up in her head. "Next thing, you'll be joining the PNC.
Fuck off, Felicity, thought Tess, and she turned Cecilia's keys in the ignition with a deft flick of the wrist. Chapter 22. What was wrong with Cecilia this morning? She was certainly not herself, mused Rachel, as she walked into St. Angela's, feeling peculiar and self-conscious about her bouncy, flat-footed walk in her sneakers instead of her normal heels. She could feel moisture in her armpits and along her hairline. But actually, walking instead of driving to work had left her feeling quite invigorated. Before she'd left the house this morning, she'd momentarily considered calling a taxi because she felt so exhausted after last night. She'd been up for hours after Rodney Bellark had left, mentally replaying that video of Janie and Connor in her head, over and over. Each time she remembered Connor's face, it became more malevolent in her memory. Rodney was just being cautious, not wanting her to get her hopes up. He was old now, and a bit soft around the edges. Once a snappy, smart young police officer saw the video, he, or she, would instantly see the implications and take decisive action. What would she do if she ran into Connor Whitby at school today? Confront him? Make the accusation? The thought made her feel dizzy. Her emotions would surely soar like mountains. Grief, fury, hatred. She took a deep breath. No, she would not confront him. She wanted this done properly, and she didn't want to forewarn him or say something that might cost her a guilty verdict. Imagine if he got off on a legal technicality because she couldn't keep her mouth shut. She felt an unexpected sense of not quite happiness, but something. Hope. Satisfaction. Yes, it was satisfaction, because she was doing something for Janie. That was it. It had been so long since she'd been able to do something, anything, for her daughter. To go into her bedroom on a cold night and place an extra blanket over those bony shoulders. Janie felt the cold. To make her one of her favourite cheese and pickle sandwiches, with heaps of butter. Rachel was always secretly trying to fatten her up. To carefully hand-wash her good clothes. To give her a $10 note for no reason at all. For years she'd felt this desire to do something again for Janie. To still be her mother. To look after her again in some small way. And now at last she could. I'm getting him, darling. Not much longer now. Her mobile phone rang in her handbag, and she fumbled for it, anxious to catch the caller before the silly thing stopped ringing and went to voicemail. It must be Rodney. Who else would call at this time of the morning? With news already? But surely it was too soon. It couldn't possibly be him. Hello? She'd seen the name just before she answered. Rob, not Rodney. The R.O. had given her a moment of hope. Mum, everything all right? She tried not to feel aggrieved with Rob.